These are big subjects. Now that we have done what we have done in the course, I'm able to say to you that I feel I can talk about subjects like this with a good conscience, provided I take a moment to let you know, I know, that you know, that I'm going to be talking much of the time on levels of abstraction that are rather high. And therefore, I will be necessarily projecting a good deal my own evaluations into what I say. But so long as I know you know that, and you know I know that, we have a bargain, and we can talk. I can talk, and you can listen, and in this way, because we have the bargain, we can forestall a good deal of the use of bickering that we might indulge in, silently at least, if not out loud, about whether or not some of the statements that I make or that you would want to make could be made. Yes, they can be made. They must be evaluated. You can't always be precise. There are some questions that cannot be talked about in a language that's entirely precise. We'll talk about them anyway then. We'll do the best we can. And we are tolerant of each other in trying to do this because it is difficult. And there may be differences of opinion and feeling about some of these matters. All right, there are differences, and we learn to live with them. But there are two reactions to difficulty of trying to deal with problems that I think we probably can't look upon with much favor. One is to ignore the problems that are difficult to talk about. I don't think this is being either reasonable, scientific, defensible in any other way. The other is to talk about problems like this, but insist that everybody agree with us. This is also impractical. Not very scientific, not very semantic, not very reasonable. So we share what we have to share about problems like this. So I'm going to share with you now some of my perceptions and evaluations with regard to the problem of learning to learn, which I think is terribly fundamental. And I'm really attempting in this slide to equate what I mean by learning to learn with some other terms that I might also use. Learning to explore, to investigate, that is to explore in a more systematic way. When you know what it is you're looking for, as it were, or you're trying to evaluate something that you want to know more about. Question, doubt, wonder, and to listen. What I mean by listen here, you could go on and on. To listen, to look, as in an art museum, to read in a way in which would be conducive to learning, and above all, to revise. These, as I perceive the behavior of people learning, these are some of the kinds of things they do that appear to me, as I evaluate this behavior, Notice my wording. I'm trying to talk as though I had had a course once in tenor Manning. As I evaluate the behavior I observe, the behavior of persons who are learning, trying to learn how to learn, these are kinds of activity, the words are vague, I realize this, that I think I see that are the most important. Now, let's talk about this a little more. Next slide. There are some factors which tend to militate against learning to learn. I have some here that are specific to the school situation. You know, in the last few years, there's been a good deal of activity in the general area that is called programmed instruction, or programmed learning, programmed teaching, machine learning, whatever you may have heard it referred to as. The reading I've been able to do, I took a course in this. There's a course given here, and the College of Education is rather a good one. I took it last summer. I've done some other reading. And one of the most interesting things about this approach to education is the reaction of students to it. Some of the reactions of the older students in college has been the programmed instruction is peculiar in this sense. They come out of course, if taught this way, with the feeling that they haven't learned anything. The reason is that it is too much fun. It isn't dull. It isn't threatening. They had no anxieties about this. And it was easy. And to them, this just couldn't be learning. And this is a real problem. And the attempt to use program instruction. There are students who are bothered by it. For these reasons, it's too easy, too much fun, it doesn't involve any anxiety. For them, learning has been so highly associated with a dull kind of experience, uninteresting, boring, the boring hour, spending time. It's been hard work. It's been made hard partly because of the poorly written textbooks. I'm taking a math course this time. That math book is one of the most with examples of English prose I have ever seen. It must be terribly discouraging to students to attempt to understand that English language that's used in that book. And this is the kind of thing that has so often been associated with what is called learning. Many textbooks are not an adult. They're really difficult to read. They're poorly written. They're written in an indirect voice, for one thing. There's, in my math text, there isn't a sentence I've pronounced about anybody doing anything. It's about the numbers doing something. It's almost animistic. It's a kind of a ghostly style, as though this were about some kind of entities that were that we're changing. The book could be greatly improved if the author would only be willing to write about a person who's operating on the symbol. And if he were to say, now you do this with this. No, he doesn't do that. It's an indirect, sort of impersonal, disembodied English about nobody. Doing nothing for something that is behaving all by itself. Well, too often we write about history almost, which is the last thing that you would imagine you could do this with. As though it were about, not about people, but about nations doing something. And so often the English of the classroom is impersonal in the sense that one says, the teacher says, the author says, that one observes. Not that I do, one does. Who's one? It isn't obvious at all who one is. This makes it difficult to understand things. There are many other things. Make learning difficult. For one thing, the courses are not always well organized. The books are not well organized. It's difficult very often to know what it is you're expected to do. Well, when you teach by programming, you have to organize very, very well by small increments, by small steps. In a logical order. It's very hard to do this. And when this is done, well, it results in a kind of language that is easy to read. And the programming is also done, according to Skinner and others who have worked on this, according to their theories of learning, so that the student is able to get the correct response almost all the time. Having answered the last question, now the odds are almost always more than 20 to 1 that he'll be able to answer the next one. So it's easy. You feel successful all the time. And that is strange to many students. They usually have felt, ordinarily, they felt failure more than success. Programming is so designed as to result in feeling success because the theoreticians who are doing this assume that success leads to success, that success tends to be motivated, that this is reinforcing of the behavior that you're carrying on, the learning behavior. I think that it might help to point out what is involved in learning to learn a bit if we examine some of the reasons why we don't always learn to learn as well as we would. Otherwise, and among these reasons are the fact that we can learn about learning, that it is unpleasant, it's dull, it's hard, and this tends to militate against a learning to learn. May I have the next slide? There are other reasons like this, but I don't want to belabor the point because you can take it from there and do what you want to do. There are some positive factors, and I more or less just turned around what I had just said. But I think it is very important to be confronted now and then with words like these. I think if you were to go to a nursery school, or if you were to watch your own little children, you would almost have to conclude that to a child, learning is just about the most fun there is. There's just nothing quite so much fun apparently to a child as discovering something new, as learning to do things, to put things together, to take them apart, to manipulate them. Learning to read is just a delight. Everything a child learns seems to be associated for him with pleasure, with excitement. I think it is one of the very most serious questions we could ask ourselves, if you agree with what I've just said. What accounts for the change from the delightfulness that a child seems to experience in learning, and the boredom that you so often see among adults in a classroom? How do you account for this? I think it is possible to associate learning activity with delight, with the feeling that what is being done is easy to do. It doesn't need to be made drudgery. It isn't when it is at its best. And it can be made rewarding. It doesn't have to be meaningless. You don't have to use first grade readers and say nothing that are meaningless, that are boring. I think that whoever has contrived these first grade readers that are about Jane and Jerry jumping up and jumping down and doing nothing all day long, and they're not real anyway. I think they, this is my evaluation, you understand, we have a bargain. I'm talking from inside Johnson. I know it. To evaluate it. I'll also be doing the best I can to evaluate it before it gets to you. That's the best I can do. I think that people who write those readers have a very profound misunderstanding of what is involved in education, in learning, in growing up, in developing one's ability to deal with the environment. I think that these kinds of books tend to create a disinterest in reading. They don't always, you know, and you may be one of the exceptions. Children who come through the first and second, third, and fourth grade and continue to like to read. There are some. But every now and then the Gallup poll is concerned with the reading habits of adult Americans. And the results are, to me, terribly depressing. If I remember rightly, the last one of these, this is approximately accurate. But half, a little over half, of college graduates, not the general population, but the college graduates, had not read a book in the last year. Now, this has to be explained. I think this is a hypothesis, and at that, a vague one, hard to do much about, but testable, I think, eventually in principle, that the way in which reading is taught from the very beginning has the effect, because of the meaningless character of the material, pretty largely, has the effect of decreasing, not encouraging, desire to read. I think the way to encourage a desire to read is to make it worthwhile, to make it just just as meaningful as you can. I don't think we should go back to the McGuffey readers, but there was one thing about them that was, I think, very sound. They were about somebody. They were about something that was important. Sometimes it was more important, perhaps, to an adult than it was to a first grader. That was a rather minor fault, it seems to me, compared to the faults of the books we have now. This is pretty much my opinion. I know this. And I know that you may reject it. And I'd be interested to hear your opinion. There's one. Am I? Now, I'd like to know a little bit more about the data. How does he know they're delightful? What are his criteria in this? I remember I had a vivid experience, and this is just one experience, and it's all it's worth. I have a little friend who was, at the time, was 6 years old. She was learning to read. Her family took me from a town to another town one afternoon. So she brought along her book, and it was a Jane and Harry book. And in this one, they were jumping up, 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 and jumping down, down, down. All the way from Washington to Hershey. By the time we got to Fredericksburg, this little girl was very much confused. She was sometimes reading it wrong, because I had her right by me, and I was reading the book and she read it. This was apparently confusing to her. There were not enough words, there were too many words that were used over and over with not enough distinction about what they were about. It doesn't matter much whether Jane jumps up or down. Even to this little girl, it didn't make much difference, apparently. And she often would say up when the book sat down, by the time we got out of town 50 miles. And she got into the book 30 or 40 pages. I would think this would be horribly confusing. Now, maybe she also showed that she was getting some kind of fun or pleasure or something out of this, because she wanted to read it to me. She was enjoying reading it to me. The fact that she made these errors, I don't think meant anything to her. I don't think she knew she was making them. I wondered if she wouldn't possibly get much more delight out of a book that was about Columbus discovering America. Or she wouldn't, and it could be written, I think, in just a simple words. That's what was the point. And I don't know whether there is very much point to that. These little words that the children are introduced to first are, in general, the words that are the very most difficult to define. They're little words. The little words are used the most, and those are the words that are, you'd have to be a very sophisticated linguist to say anything very very definitive about the word is, for example. It'd be much easier, I would think, for a child to understand a word like highway, automobile. These are long words, and a word like influenza, if he's had it. I think he's kind of much more meaningful. I don't know, it's very much point to trying to regulate the vocabulary. If you just use English the way it comes, all the language studies have shown that when you count the words in language samples, it hardly matters how you get them. You get about the same word frequencies. I think all this fuss about getting exactly the right word frequencies is rather misguided. Just English as it is used has the most valid word frequencies, it seems to me, that you could teach a child. Those are the ones he's going to encounter. And if you take English as you do, 10% of all the words the child reads, they're going to be counted for with 10 different words. And that's not hard. And 100 different words are going to count for 3/4. We've gone over this. Well, maybe enough of this, but I don't want to keep you from talking more. If you want. This happens to be one of my, what shall I call it, hobbies, or my little pet crusades. So I have run into lots of people who are experts. Over coffee and whatnot, which talk over. That's kind of the next one, so. I want to pick out revising to talk about in the little time we have. I think, well, what I'm going to say is not, as far as I can see, very profound, it's pretty obvious, yet revising is something that has been so little investigated or considered that appears to be very easy to be a little original, even by pointing out things that are rather obvious. When you try to break down what it is you do when you revise something that you have said or written or painted, these are some terms which appear to me to make it possible to communicate with others, perhaps, about what appears to be going on. The author who revises, or the patient in the clinic who revises, what he says about himself, or the student in the history course who revises what had said in the past about Canada before he took a course in the history of Canada. Although I think in our schools nobody takes such a course. They appear to be clarifying some of the time. Revising involves the using very often of more words rather than less, or words that are more descriptive, that are on a lower level of abstracting, in order to use more examples and details and more precise words referring to place and time and color and size and other things that will help clarify what we've been talking about. The trouble with many first drafts is that they're not developed. So much revising consists of extending, of developing the implications, of putting the meat on the skeleton, as it were. So that very often, when you listen to what you have said before, You want to say, oh, I meant much more than that. I haven't developed that as much as I should. When you read what you've written before, you want to stick in a paragraph here and there to develop something. You've only suggested things, perhaps, so that you've forgotten to mention at all. The modifying this is often it takes the form of clarifying, but sometimes there are errors that one discovers, and so you correct what you now recognize to have been an error. The attempt to get histories from clinical cases or from mothers, fathers, concerning their own children involves a good deal of this type of revising. The second or the third time through, which isn't ordinarily done, but I have done a little of this for research purposes, the second or third time through, there's a good deal of revising that consists of actually changing. It isn't a matter of making something more specific or elaborating it. It's a matter of changing the date. It wasn't 1943. It was 1944. It wasn't in the winter. It was in the summer, etc., etc. It wasn't the measles. It was the mumps. It wasn't Johnny who had the measles. It was the older brother who had them, and so on. And almost any account that you give of anything that has happened to you or that you remember is likely to be revised as far as the second or third draft. We need much more research about the reasons for the errors we do make. It wouldn't be hard to develop some hypotheses about the associations that we tend to make for errors. And then the most significant kind of revising, I think, is that in which we replace what we said before. We delete it. And we say something else entirely different. As we grow up, we do a good deal of this. We stop talking like children and begin to say things we never said before. Instead, as we become more mature, we are likely to become, for instance, more realistic. And so we talk less about our wishes and more about our hard-nosed predictions. And so the revising is a matter of deleting something that we no longer want to defend and replacing it with something that we feel is more defensible. Now, we can do this kind of thing on all levels of abstract. I think it helps a good deal to think about revising, to put it in that frame of reference. If you were to write your autobiography and then were to do a second draft of it, a good deal of your revising would consist of taking statements that you had made in the first draft that were rather general on high levels of abstraction and develop them on lower levels. And you would take a few statements here and there that were fragments of information, of detail, and develop the implications of it on higher levels of abstract. I think when it comes to deleting, most of what you would delete would be found on higher levels of abstract. You wouldn't very often delete descriptive writing, descriptives suspicions that were reasonably accurate. Statements like that are timeless. They're as good 10 years from now as they are now. The data never wear out to the degree that they're reliable and valid. It's the conclusions that you change. It's evaluations that you are constantly revising. When we say that we change our mind, we don't usually mean that we change our information. We change our generalizations about it. It's on the higher levels of abstraction that we do most of the very significant devices. I believe I have another slide on me. There are some questions that are to be observed. That is, the person who is effectively revising can be observed asking certain kinds of questions. What are your undefined terms? By undefined terms, if maybe the book has not made this fully clear, I haven't either, perhaps, I don't know. In terms of the levels of abstraction, again, process of abstraction, remember we talked about definition of terms. You can define a word.
Take the word love.
You can define this, to remember, extensionally or descriptively, or in terms of general classification, that it is, or some kind of an explanatory statement to be made which implies what you mean by it or which develops what you mean by it. Well now, when you have said all you can about what you mean by love, and someone has asked you to define all the terms you have used in defining it, and you've defined all those, and they've asked you to define the words you use, defining the words you use to define love, well, eventually, you know, you come to a point where you're through. You said all you can. You've used all the words you've got. So you come to a point at which you say, beyond this, love is an undefined term. It can be defined then, beyond that, only extensionally, but no more verbally. By undefined term, in this sense, this rather technical sense, we mean verbally undefined. Now, if you will examine your usual language behavior, when you're talking about almost anything, you'll find that you have a set of undefined terms. They're the terms that you start with. You don't bother to wonder about them. When you're talking about education, I suspect that much of the time when you talk about education, the word learning would be undefined. You don't stop to try to make clear what you mean by learning. You assume everybody knows what you mean by learning. Probably teaching is another such term. When you're talking about language, probably word is a word that is undefined as a rule. When you're talking about morals or ethics, probably terms like right or wrong tend to be undefined, as though everybody knew right and wrong. So if you're going to revise what you have said in the past, what you have written, one of the very most effective ways to work at this is to try to identify the terms you're using as though you were taking for granted that everybody knew what these words mean. They're undefined terms. What are they? Now, take a look at them. What do you tend to mean by them? What does your, what do the statements in which you use these words seem to be about? When you're talking about love, what is it you seem to be talking about? When you're talking about learning, what is it you seem to be talking about? And you will usually find that you probably can do some defining. But to the degree that you can't, you will at least be more attentive to the sentences you make with these words, so that it might be a little more obvious to someone else what you're talking about, as well as to you. What are the assumptions you seem to be taking for granted? Almost everybody seems to assume, for example, in talking about their own behavior, in talking about, let's make it specific, in talking about the difficulties they have getting along with other people, the misunderstandings and disagreements. If you listen to most discussions about this, I think you would have to conclude that, as a rule, persons who talk about such things are assuming that the difficulties they have in getting along with others are due to somebody, are due to persons, sometimes themselves, sometimes others, but they're due to persons. And they ask such questions as, who's to blame? Whose fault is it? But the word who there is important. The assumption seems to be that it is a person. You hardly ever hear anybody talking about such things and asking what's to blame. This would be a rather sophisticated person who has another set of assumptions about reasons for our behavior. Most of the discussions that you will hear about human problems that we usually classify in clinical ways as diseases or as personality maladjustments, behavior difficulties, these discussions are carried on as though the assumptions were being made that the causes of the problem are to be found inside the person who is said to be the patient or the one with the problem. This is a sort of an unstated assumption that the cause and the disease are both to be found, the cause and the disorder and the problem, are both to be found within one bag of skin, as it were. But it takes a very sophisticated person to talk about such things in terms of, for instance, learning, the learning process, in terms of interactions between and among persons, in terms of interactions between cultural factors, for example, and individual experience factors. The persons who talk this way are talking with an altogether different set of assumptions. So revising very often consists of making one's assumptions explicit, sometimes for the first time in our life. And then this will usually lead to considerable revising, because once we make the assumptions explicit, there are a good many specific statements we want to change. So often we're talking about ourselves and each other and the problems we have in various situations. We don't bother to state what our criteria are. We make judgments of each other. He's an honest guy, or he's a competent fellow. Marries a very lovely girl. But we hardly ever bother to make clear what our standards are. And so revising often takes the form of making our criteria explicit, of writing them in, of spelling them out. This is especially true if you're going to judge persons in any way that would make a significant difference to them in a school, or a clinic, or a hospital, or in an employment situation. One of the most troublesome problems in industry is the evaluation that is carried on of personnel, employees, by their supervisors, as a means of trying to decide which ones are to be promoted, etc., etc. The criterion problem is not only stubborn and difficult to solve, it's terribly serious to the individuals concerned and to the organizations concerned. So much of the revising of statements about people in such situations consists of making much more clear the criteria, the standards against which you were judging the person. There's another slide. I've got just about 2 minutes. Much of revising, when you do it with a high degree of awareness of abstracting and the dynamics of the relationships among and between the levels of abstracting, takes the form of placing a great deal more